It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at some Wisconsinites going to Minnesota for the newly legal same-sex marriages there.
Now, though, a visit to the garage.
Our next guest is a guitarist and a music professor at Alverno College in Milwaukee. He explored the world of garage and basement rock bands.
And what about you? Have you ever been in a garage band? Or do you have fond memories of playing in a friend's band? What is that culture like? What does it feel like to jam out in a garage? You can call us or email. You can ring us up at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Peter Roller joins us now. His new book is Milwaukee Garage Bands, Generations of Grassroots Rock. Peter, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be here.
First of all, let's get our definition straight. What is a garage band?
So I usually call that an amateur rock band. Mm-hmm. And there's been confusion because this genre of rock, garage rock, is often done by professionals. I would say mostly what they've called garage rock over the years has actually been done by professionals. But garage bands, as we all know, are just teenagers usually learning how to play together with their buddies.
Well, you interviewed people in garage bands from about the last 50 years. Did you get a sense of what the appeal is of being in a garage band that's never probably going to make it big?
Yeah, that's the central question that I pose in the introduction, that there's these quickie ideas that everyone gets into something like a rock band only to try to be a star or be an American idol. And also those things like guys get into it just to get a chick, in quotes. And I wanted to see why hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people have played down in the basement and sometimes in garages and generally been pretty happy just doing it at that level and maybe going to their school and playing something. So I interviewed a lot of people from the late 50s all the way through the 90s about really their very first bands. And I would say, to answer your question, the social interplay of being with people who are in your same grade usually, who are eventually become friends, and to make those loud electric guitar band sounds together is fun in itself.
Now, you're a guitar guy. Did you play in a basement or in a garage when you were, say, a teenager?
Yeah, in northern New Jersey, it's a little like Milwaukee, not quite as cold, in that most seasons of the year, you're going to want to be in the basement. And it was a suburban neighborhood, so almost every house had basement, if not a basement rec room. And it's the rare occurrence when you actually, in summertime, go up to the garage. And I found in Milwaukee, usually it was purposely to give a semi-public performance, but we can get to that later. It's about going down to an enclosed space where you and your buddies can kind of make that racket on your own and be independent from adults, even though it annoys them upstairs.
Well, that's the bonus part.
Yeah, that's part of the rock rebellion at its junior level.
Well, who are some of your favorite garage bands from Milwaukee over the years?
Well, I told kind of the hero of my book, because he's the earliest guy documenting a rock band in Milwaukee, Sam McHugh, who eventually was in this semi-famous band called The Legends. I wrote in his dedication to the book, I said, if this was a Ken Burns documentary about jazz, you would be the Louis Armstrong figure. If you know those Ken Burns, he always brings back one or two figures throughout. And Sam McHugh is a guy who represents the pre-Beatles, pre-60s time of rock and roll, which is really underrepresented. There's this lightweight pop music journalism idea that there were only garage bands after the Beatles hit and everybody fell in love with the British invasion in the mid-60s. Yes, there was a big spike then, and I'm part of that generation. But rock and roll started in the United States, and it started to spread all over the U.S. in the 50s. So Sam McHugh, in my book, very clearly describes around 1955, 1956, hearing this amalgamation of different music that wasn't even called rock and roll yet, but it was teenagers that would eventually have what we would call rock and roll bands. They loved electric guitar, which they could hear in country and rockabilly, but they also loved hearing it from black blues guys like Freddie King, who did instrumentals. And they just eventually just had this great desire to do that with other teenagers, and that's what started what we would call garage bands. And he had his first band in 1956 on the south side of Milwaukee.
Well, I actually pulled a clip from one of his bands. You mentioned Legends. This is Lariat. Let's give a listen.
Yeah.
So listening to that, I think Ventures, who came along, I think a little later, but is that the same spirit of the era?
Well, the sound of the electric guitar is a big draw, and it still is to this day. So I call them electric guitar bands as much as I call them rock bands. And as we know, there's all different levels of volume and tone and everything, but there's still this love for making that loud sound through electric guitar band instruments. He clearly is from that era, and what's exciting about that is that they went ahead and didn't just cover the Ventures. They wrote some of their own instrumentals, and then all the local bands wouldn't just play those Ventures things. They would play Lariat in this town, and in this town only, you can find all kinds of garage band guys all the way through the 60s who play Lariat by the Legends.
So there are some of these bands that might not have hit the national scene really huge, but they did get a following in their hometown in Milwaukee.
Well, that's why I selected Sam as more like a Louis Armstrong figure for the Ken Burns, and that he's the rare guy that he loved his beginning rock days, and they were the earliest days, but he did a lot of different things in his career. He did not feel that that's what was needed to validate his involvement in music, because he moved back from L.A. to the south side of Milwaukee in the 80s, and he just started playing as a working musician with blues bands and oldies rock and roll bands. And I asked him about that, and he said, you know what, I played with the Everly Brothers, I played in Europe and played all over the country, but every gig I play is a local gig.
All right, we're going to take a call now. We've got Bill in New Berlin on the line. Hi, Bill. Bill, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can, yeah. What did you want to mention?
Well, I discovered a garage band here locally, and built up their reputation in town. They got $1,200 a night gigs in bars and such. And then they joined the USO tour and toured the world. And then they were hired in Mexico to cut a 5-record album set. And they've been going strong ever since.
Who is the band?
They're called the Britons.
The Britons. And
yeah,
are they?
They started out as a Beatles lookalike group. Sound-alike group.
Gotcha. The Britons. Are you familiar with them, Peter?
Yeah, they're one of the sort of tribute bands that does Beatles shows. But I think what's interesting there, that I think that the guy who called in said, is that they started out as a neighborhood rock band together. And that's really what I'm focusing on, is that first wave really imprints on you things that make you enjoy doing this rock band music, whether or not you go all the way to Japan or not.
Is there a difference, do you think, you know, in where the band practices, if they're a genuine garage band practicing in a garage, or whether they're just, you know, kind of jamming in a basement?
No, it's really just different regions with different climates. So I imagine if I had done my research in Florida or in Southern California, I truly would have been hearing a lot about people clearing out the garage and doing music there. I know the Beach Boys literally did that in their suburban L.A. house. But it's about being in a separate room and being able to make your own music, even though it's at a very low level. The main value that I found in it was, even if you're a know-nothing, brand-new rock musician, it's your music, it's your buddies and your music, and that feels really good, and that makes you feel like an individual.
Speaking of being an isolated space, you talk in your book about cocooning, where a band gears up, hunkers down, and does some recording. Tell us a little more about cocooning.
So everything in my book comes out of oral history testimony by people who've been in garage bands in the Milwaukee area, and I just want to give credit. That came from a guy named Richard Regner, who eventually became a chef, and really had clear memories of his Whitefish Bay suburban teenage years, and he basically said, what saved me in Whitefish Bay was having this series of garage bands where we could go down in the basement, often at his house, and really cook up these really creative sort of outlooks for the whole band. It was already up to the late 60s, early 70s, where a lot of things were being tried. So for one era of cocooning, he said he was like Dan Hicks in the Hot Licks, where he was kind of like doing this old throwback kind of thing with female backup singers. And another time he was doing the kind of Western swing, Eagles country rock thing. So he just felt that the creativity that they could brew in the basement and then bring out for maybe one talent show kind of got him through his suburban teen years.
We're talking to Peter Roller. His new book is Milwaukee Garage Bands, Generations of Grassroots Rock.
And we're taking your calls. Have you been in a garage band? Do you have fond memories of that? Or do you remember a friend's band? What do you think about the whole garage band culture? And maybe it's changed now that it's so much easier to record. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking now to Peter Roller. His new book is called Milwaukee Garage Bands, Generations of Grassroots Rock.
We'll get to your calls in just a moment about garage bands you've known or played in, for that matter. But first, Peter, I want to give another listen to a band. This is the Mustard Men. Let's check them out. Well, Peter, if I'm not mistaken, that's kind of the archetype of a three-chord rock song.
And it's actually the three chords of the most famous recorded garage band song, Louie Louie, from the early 60s. But I believe Warren Wiegratz, who's a famous musician in Milwaukee, who was the main interviewee for the Mustard Men, said, yeah, they knew how to play Louie Louie and many other songs, and when they got to writing their own song to record a single, they just used the basic DNA of Louie Louie to get their own song going. And this is now a collectible, obscure garage rock song that has been put out in compilations.
And how did the early Mustard Men experience go? How did they get started as a garage band?
Yeah, that's one of the favorite stories. It's before the Beatles hit, so one of the main things I'm also trying to document is there's always been amateur teen garage bands. It didn't just take Beatlemania to start that. So circa 1962, 63, they were in Elm Grove. But Warren was very clear that they were in this more working-class neighborhood that was a lot like West Allis, but they were going to Brookfield schools, which are more upper-middle class. And so they formed this band in their neighborhood. They were loving playing all different kinds of music, meaning soul, R&B, and garage rock kind of songs. And they just were the first ones to play teen dances in the whole West Suburban area. So they felt very strongly like they went from these guys who came from the wrong side of the tracks on their bus every day to being sort of the kings of their whole suburban area, because they were the first band that proved that teenagers, not DJs, could present rock music for dances, and the kids loved them, and they loved that name. They had mustard-colored jackets, and they had mustard splashes on their band van and all kinds of fun stuff.
All right, well, let's go to the phone. So we've got a call here from Mike in Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hi, Rob, Veronica, and Peter. How you doing?
Good, hi. Thanks.
I just was calling to share something quick. It's not actually a Wisconsin band, although I did manage a band from southern Wisconsin called Diaz Mali, and we ended up opening up for some major acts, but there were some problems, and you know, with those personal lives, so that band disbanded. But the story I had was I got to watch Rob Thomas of Matchbox 20. I lived with those guys in Florida for a while, and it was neat just watching them. We were in a garage band, but our living room was transformed into basically a small stage. You know, we had the Marshall stacks, the set of TVs, and
oh boy, but that was just loud.
it was loud, and luckily we were all on the same shift, so it didn't affect us too much sleep-wise. But it was just neat watching us. We would just throw weekly neighborhood parties, and and it was just nice. Actually, the original band, if there's any fans out there, Rob Thomas, was called Tabitha's Secret. And that's where the original 3 a.m. hit came out of, and a few other of their big hits.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot. Well, that reminds me, you talked some about garage bands that make it big. Who made it big from the garage scene in Milwaukee?
Well, we already talked about Sam McHugh moving into the Legends, and they had a one-hit wonder song in the Midwest called Say Mama that was on the charts in the Milwaukee area for like 6 months. And so every garage band from the early 60s to the late 60s played this Say Mama only in Milwaukee. Another one that is documented in my book, even though I tend to do more just neighborhood anonymous people, is Brian Ritchie of the Violin Femmes. He was very generous with me. The Femmes had split up for a while, and they just reunited this past summer. And during that split-up time, he was in Brooklyn, New York at first, and so he let me visit during a Packer game. We watched a Packer game together, and he told me about his earliest days. And whether it's someone who became a rock star or an anybody, they remember these garage bands really clearly 20, 30, 40 years later. So his most interesting thing about his garage band in junior high was he lived in a rare integrated neighborhood on the north side of Milwaukee. So his garage band actually was formed with this neighbor, an African-American kid who had learned all kinds of music in his preacher dad's black gospel church. And so he came and knocked on his door when he could hear him playing electric guitar and said, "Who's that playing? Let's form a band and make some music together." And they had a totally integrated repertoire. Brian's bringing in Stones and Velvet Underground. Melvin's bringing in Marvin Gaye and the Ohio Players, and they were the kings of their junior high.
Wow. Well, that's a great story. And thanks to our caller, Mike, for his cool story about Matchbox 20, too. Now let's go back to the phones and pick up Michael in Milwaukee. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Well, I'm calling because I'm, of course, everyone kind of that starts plays in a band kind of starts in a garage band. So I guess I'm kind of in a garage band at that point. But I'm in a band that's starting to gain some minor success, and it's really fun, and garage bands are awesome, but the social media sites, I think, sometimes kind of make it a little bit too easy for a band to start out, and it kind of floods the market with new bands, and it's kind of hinders us. As much as it would be nice to have more bands on the scene, there's more beginner bands, and then there's nowhere to go after that.
That's an interesting perspective, but I got to ask you before we go on, what's your band called?
Oh, Conniption.
Conniption. All right.
Nice
I don't
name.
Know if you've heard of them yet, Peter, but what do you think about the social media and the way it's changed the game?
Yeah, things have changed with the internet age. So if bands are brave enough, and I guess from the caller they are, they can put all kinds of stuff out there. And I find that they wanted to go out a little bit from the basement in every era, but this internet age can kind of expose them very widely, and I'm not sure what that's all going to come to, but I'm sure they still love making that loud electric guitar band music together down in the basement and at some local live situations.
I want to check out one more band that you write about in your book. This is Finch, Nothing in the Sun. And that's a little later than the other ones we pulled. Almost psychedelic there, I think, Peter.
Yeah, and there's 50 pictures of garage bands all from the Milwaukee area in my book. And the two pictures of Scott Finch's two bands tell the story of what you just played. They had a Beatles-era band called the Palmettos because, oddly, they lived in a suburban area called Palmetto Avenue. And Mom said, "Why don't you just call yourself the Palmettos?" They look very neat with their skinny ties and their matching jackets. Mm-hmm. And then 2 years later, he's holding a homemade sitar, and they all have Indian kind of Nehru jackets or shirts on, and they've named their band Finch after the movie A Man Called Finch, and he's even changed his last name from Scott Janicki to Scott Finch because people just started calling him Finch all the time. So basically they were extremely creative, and Scott Finch stayed in music as an engineer, producer, studio owner, and guitar player for the rest of his life, and he was named by his second garage band, Finch.
I think we've got time for one more quick call. Steve in Madison, you're up.
Hello.
Hey.
Hello. I played in a rock and roll garage band in the 60s, and I first saw actually Sammy McHugh when I was 12 years old in 1961 at a bar mitzvah, and later got to know him after he got back from Europe in the playing with the Everly Brothers. But our garage band was from Racine, and we played Lariat. We played, and of course Sammy McHugh recorded Bopalina as
yes.
well, and we cut a couple records at Kuka Records and toured around the state in Illinois and Michigan for a while, and just wanted to say that in about an hour I'm heading for my current garage band practice.
All right, still rocking. Thanks a lot, Steve. Do people stick with this, or do they hang up their guitars when they hit a certain age usually, Peter?
Yeah, I do cover this a little bit at the end of the book, and I'm pointing where things are going to go in the future, and I call it the baby boomerang. People, when they have a little more time, they start playing more basically in the basement bands again, and the one band I cover was called the Crows in the mid-60s playing CYO dances on the south side of Milwaukee. They did call themselves the Crows because they were a very bluesy band. They were white guys who tried to play black music, and then they all worked their jobs. They even went to Vietnam and stayed in touch, came back together, moved out to the far-flung suburbs like Franklin, and they reformed playing together every week in the basement of one of the guys' houses. The wife of one of them said, "Why do you guys get together every week like that and play?" And they said, "Well, you women are in a book club, so we're going to call our band the Book Club." So the Crows, and it's documented with pictures in my book, became the Book Club. And that shows that people love it so much at the garage band level that they often just keep doing it, or they reprise it with a 20 or 30 year gap in between.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. A lot of fun.
I just want to say historypress.net. There's two different history presses out there, so if anybody wants more information about them.
Yeah, that's Peter Roller. The book you could look up is Milwaukee Garage Band's Generations of Grassroots Rock. This is Central Time.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll continue our Hidden Wisconsin series where we speak with people around the state about what their jobs are like behind the scenes.
Today we'll be speaking with family physicians about what it's like to deliver babies. But before we get to that, today is the first day that same-sex couples can get married in Minnesota.
This is drawing some Wisconsinites across the border. WPR reporter Maureen McCollum is in Minnesota today with a Wisconsinite couple getting married, and she joins us by phone. Maureen, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob.
Now, you're going to be witnessing a wedding today. Who's getting married?
I am. It's a couple from Fountain City, Wisconsin. They've been together for, I believe, 15 years, if not longer. And they've actually talked about moving to La Crosse. And now they're talking about moving to Minnesota since they're going to be getting married in Minnesota. One of the women is the president of the LGBT Center in La Crosse. And they're both professors. They both have successful careers and are very, very excited about today.
Is their marriage going to be recognized back on this side of the border?
No. In Wisconsin, under law, same-sex marriages are not permitted and they're not recognized. So what it'll mean for them, if they do continue living in Wisconsin, is that they will be able to receive federal benefits. And with DOMA being overturned, you know, all those details are still being worked out. But essentially, they won't be able to get the state benefits in Wisconsin, but they can get the federal benefits. And I believe they're registered as a domestic partnership, so they can continue receiving the domestic partnership benefits, even though they're still married.
They are not the only ones, right? You've been trying to track down how many Wisconsin couples are filing for a marriage license in Minnesota. What have you found out so far?
It really depends on the county. You know, in the smaller counties, they're able to track it a little better because they're only getting a couple marriage licenses on any given week anyways. So in St. Louis County, which is where Duluth is located, one of the staffers there told me that they've had three Wisconsin couples apply, and that was out of about 37 couples. And they haven't really been differentiating between genders. And that's what the larger counties will say, too. When I called the counties in the Twin Cities area, they say, you know, because marriage license applications no longer state gender on there, they're not really tracking. I'm sure eventually they will, maybe once this week kind of goes through. But it is a little scattered. And, you know, some of the smaller counties, more rural counties in Minnesota along the border of Wisconsin, they have seen like one or two couples. So, you know, people, of course, are excited because this is the first day. But I also talked with a county recorder, which that's the Minnesota version of a county clerk. And, you know, they've heard of couples, too, some same-sex couples who just want to take their time and plan out their wedding. And when they're ready, they'll get married.
And they're changing the marriage license and the licensing process, right? You mentioned it doesn't say bride or groom anymore. What are they doing?
Now, instead of listing bride and groom, it'll say applicant one and applicant two. And there's some other language in the application, too, where it just refers to couples. So it just eliminates all gender-biased terminology.
And talking to the couple you're following today, you mentioned the possibility that they're considering moving to Minnesota. Did I get that right?
Correct. Yeah, they are thinking about moving to La Crescent, which is a Minnesota town just across the river from La Crosse. And I'm not really sure where they're at with that. Now I'll find out, once we talk after their wedding. But when the legislators passed gay marriage this spring, I was talking with a handful of people from La Crosse, just, about their reaction to it. And immediately, lots of couples were like, oh, we're moving to Minnesota. Now, last time I talked to this couple, the one who's getting married today, they said that excitement's kind of died down. They're still considering, and they've heard of just one other couple who's thinking about moving. But, that's just the La Crosse area. We, share fourth of our state with the border of Minnesota, so there could be couples all over Minnesota or all over Wisconsin thinking about moving to Minnesota.
As you're following the story in the future, are you thinking there are going to be a lot of weird legal wrinkles to iron out?
I think so. One very interesting law that's actually still on the books in Wisconsin is this law that penalizes Wisconsin couples from entering, quote, prohibited marriages. And when I've talked to people, they said that this was a law introduced like 100 years ago, and basically it was trying to cut down on the number of young girls running off to marry older men. And it's a felony. It carries, you could spend 90 days in jail or face a $10,000 maximum fine. Now, nobody knows of anyone, at least in recent years, that's been penalized for going to Iowa or Minnesota to get married. But when I talked to the lawyer yesterday, he said it's still risky, and it's something that probably should be addressed.
We'll keep an eye on that. Maureen, thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thanks, Rob.
That was Maureen McCollum, WPR reporter in La Crosse.
Now we'll check headlines, and then it's our Hidden Wisconsin series where we go behind the scenes, this time with a couple of doctors who deliver babies, hundreds of them between the two of them. That's coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's time for the second installment of Hidden Wisconsin Now, where we get the inside scoop on the work lives of people who we may cross paths with but really know nothing about what their jobs are like.
We've gotten lots of great tips from you, from state bee inspector to sanitation worker. We're going to follow up on those for future shows.
Right now, though, we're going behind the scenes with Jency Carlson and Jamie Conniff. They're both practitioners in the University of Wisconsin Department of Family Medicine, and we're talking to them today about what it's like to deliver babies. Jency, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Jamie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Jency, let's start with you. As a family physician, you see women from conception through birth. What is it like to be involved in the process of birth?
It's amazing. And it's amazing every time I get to go through it. And the best part is, as a family doctor, we really get to take care of people from birth to death. So a lot of the women who I take care of, I took care of them before they got pregnant, talked to them about getting pregnant, took care of them through their pregnancy. And then once they have their baby, I get to see their baby and take care of those babies. I don't know, the oldest one I've delivered now is about 3. So
how many babies have you delivered?
I've delivered about 150.
Whoa.
Which is a really small number compared to some of my partners who've been practicing for years longer.
Jamie, how many have you delivered?
I think not quite that many, maybe 120 or 130.
That's amazing. I don't know. So this is Hidden Wisconsin, jobs we don't know about. But I will say, when I had my 2 children, I became really fascinated with the process of birth. And I, for a while, thought that I wanted to be involved somehow in it. What is it like as you two, you actually do this job? I mean, it felt like a miracle to me. Does it feel like a miracle to you, Jamie?
It does. I mean, it does feel kind of like a miracle every time. You know, I think when I first started delivering babies, I assumed that at some point it would get old, that, you know, the emotions of the delivery would start being less with future deliveries. And it kind of surprisingly, it really hasn't happened. And that's one of the really nice things about being involved in birth is that there are emotions, and it really does feel like a miracle, which is something that, you know, doesn't happen as much in other areas of medicine.
What about you, Jency? How would you describe the feeling?
I think it's absolutely amazing. I remember the first time I delivered a baby and thinking to myself, there's absolutely no way that's going to fit. And I think it continues to amaze me each time. And it's just amazing to get to see people's families grow and parents' reactions to their new babies. And to get to be a part of that, I get pretty emotional with every delivery, and I think if that ever went away, it might be my time to be done delivering babies.
Do you deliver all of the babies of your patients? Not all doctors do this.
Yeah. So, and that's really what we get to do as family doctors, as opposed to OBs, is that we typically follow our patients all the way through pregnancy and then come to the delivery. So we're the doctors who actually get woken up at 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. when we're not expecting it and run to the hospital to deliver a baby.
So you really see it all the way through.
Yeah.
Is there ever a time where you're in the middle of an episode of The Wire or something and it's 2 a.m. and you're eating popcorn and you think, oh my gosh, or do you just always get excited about heading out the door?
It hasn't yet where I've been disappointed. Sometimes the timing's not ideal, but it's usually just so exciting because you've gotten to see this pregnancy grow from the beginning. And so I get really excited to go to the hospital and meet my patients there.
Jamie, do you second that?
I second that, yeah. The feeling of inconvenience lasts for about 5 seconds. The feeling of, like, the emotional rush and that connection with the patient and the family lasts for, obviously, years. So it's totally worth it, being, you know, having that episode of The Wire interrupted.
So, Jamie, could you walk us through what happens from your point of view as a physician at a birth?
Sure. You know, I feel like I should probably first say that, you know, I feel like, you know, especially after delivering a baby or, you know, handing the baby up to give to the mother after it's been delivered, you know, there's a lot of thanks and credit that goes to me, which is really totally not appropriate. I've done so little in that process. It's really, obviously, the mother delivers the baby. And so, but, you know, I do have a role there, and that role is mostly to help the baby come out, guide the baby out, you know, with the least amount of damage to the baby and to the mom. So, you know, I'm very careful not to drop the baby. Rule number one is don't drop the baby.
They're awfully slippery when they come out.
I can imagine.
They're awfully slippery.
Have you, I don't know if I should ask you this, but have you ever dropped a baby?
I've never dropped a baby.
Good for you.
There's only lore about it. I don't think we know anyone
Nobody
who's
really
done it.
Drops babies.
Right, I've heard about babies being dropped, but I've never heard a name attached to those stories.
Maybe because they're not in medicine anymore. Okay, so, yeah, what is that moment like, you know, when the baby is crowning?
Right, so, yep, crowning is the term for when the baby's head is really almost out. So, you know, sometimes you can see the baby's head for a while, up to half an hour before the baby actually crowns. But when the baby crowns, so the baby's head is almost out, just the mechanics of it, and so yeah, I guess this will get a little bit graphic. Different doctors do this differently, but in general, you know, one hand, in my case, because, well, it's the way that I do it, my left hand is kind of supporting the mother's tissue. So my hand is kind of supporting the tissue between the vagina and the anus, which is called the perineum. And then the other hand is controlling the baby's head as it comes out. And the goal is to have the baby come out, but not have the baby come out too quickly, because if there's too much force behind the baby or it comes out too quickly, then that can cause more damage. So basically, you know, the first, obviously the head comes out first, and so you can control the delivery of the head and help it come out slowly. And then the shoulders come out next, and the shoulders are the broadest part of the baby. So that's where you can run into trouble if they're too broad. Most of the time they're not, and so basically you kind of help the anterior shoulder. And when I say anterior, that's in terms of the mom. So the baby's anterior shoulder has to fit underneath the pubic bone. So you kind of help, you put some downward pressure on the baby to help the anterior shoulder come out. Then you put opposite pressure to help the posterior shoulder come out without causing any, you know, too much damage to the mom. And then the rest of the baby kind of comes out on its own. And that's when not dropping the baby part gets really important.
And I know for parents who don't find out the gender, this is a big moment. This is the moment, right? What is that moment like, Gen Z, where they get to know whether they had a boy or a girl?
I frequently like to put a partner or a parent or whoever the mom support person is in charge of delivering that news. And it doesn't matter what the gender of the baby is. Everyone is excited. So it's a fun moment.
And I want to ask you, you must have stories. Not every birth is the same. In fact, every birth, I'm guessing, is different. Do you have any stories you could share with us that stick with you, Jency?
One of the stories that sticks with me is kind of my crowning jewel as a physician. I took care of a woman during her pregnancy, and during her pregnancy, she asked about my first name, which was pretty unique. And so I told her a little bit about the history, and she said, "Oh, I really like that name. I really like that name." And then when it came time to deliver her baby, and she had a baby girl, which was a surprise, they decided to name their baby. I like to say not after me, but they liked the name. They didn't dislike me. And so every time I see that baby in clinic, I always, you know, tell her that she's brilliant and funny, and she's going to live up to the name. So.
She's just like you, her namesake. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's an honor. Baby,
yes.
Kind of named after you. Yeah. What about you, Jamie?
Sure. The story that has stuck with me the most, at least so far, is actually a story about something going wrong or almost going wrong. So I am still a resident. I'm a third-year resident. And so when I deliver babies, I still have attendings, you know, supervising doctors who are in the rooms with me, just kind of watching the process and making sure that things go smoothly. And so earlier this year, I was delivering a baby, and the attending warned me before the delivery started that she had just recently started feeling a little ill. And so, sure enough, during the delivery, she passed out.
Oh, my.
And so was lying on the floor of the hospital room during the delivery, which, you know, had been going smoothly up until that moment. But then, sure enough, after the baby's head came out, the shoulders got stuck, which is what we call a shoulder dystocia. And, you know, we run through these drills in our head about how to handle that situation frequently, but it doesn't come up that often. And so... here I was, you know, basically alone, not alone because I had a couple of great nurses in the room helping me, and the three of us were trying to figure out, you know, how to deliver this baby without a supervising doctor telling us how to do it. And fortunately, you know, we kind of went through a couple of different maneuvers, and it didn't take very long to get the baby's shoulders out. And everything went smoothly, and there was a beautiful baby girl at the end of it, and I think that, you know, thankfully the mom was barely aware that we were having any difficulties. But, you know, I think I probably shook for a good, 24 hours after that.
Wow. Oh, boy. Now, that is not exactly what a birth should... What you expect your birth to be like with one of the doctors passing out. Usually, you think it's the partner who's there in the room who's going to do the passing out.
Yeah, right.
Well, I hope the physician was okay. So... Yeah, obviously these are emotional stories. Do you ever, we think of the parents crying, the mother certainly, the father, the partner. Do you guys ever cry?
I cry pretty much every time a partner cries. I am a total sympathetic crier. I do keep it to myself pretty successfully, but I just cannot avoid it.
I same for me, and I tear up. The better I know the family, the more I tear up, and yeah, it's an emotional moment.
Oh boy. Well, speaking, you know, as a patient, I would be fine with my doctor crying, just so you guys know. I think it's nice to know that everyone's in it together, and it all feels like a group effort, which it is. Yeah. Do you have a favorite part of your job, Jency?
You know, I think my favorite part that I come back to in all aspects of my job is the relationships that I get to have with people. I really care about my patients, but also they bring so much joy into my life. So I hope that I can share that in their lives as well. But those relationships make it all worth it.
And how about you, Jamie?
Yeah, I think the same thing, relationships. And I mean, really find rewarding providing care at transitions in life. And so what I really value as a family doctor is being able to be there both at the beginning of life, as someone who delivers babies, but then also at the end of life as, someone who, works with hospice and helps my patients have end of life discussions and make those decisions. And sometimes doing both of those things, delivering a baby and having an end of life discussion within a 24-hour period is just something that I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be involved in.
Do you think that it changes the way, Jamie, that you live your life? Because you do get to be present for births and deaths.
It does, absolutely. You know, my life is, you know, it's a pretty mundane one. And I, you know, I don't have any babies in my own life. And, you know, I don't, you know, have that many deaths, fortunately. And so being able to be involved in those events in other people's lives really, I think, gives me an appreciation for my life, you know, even for the mundanity of it that I wouldn't necessarily have otherwise.
Sound about right, Jency?
Yeah, that definitely sounds about right. It's such a privilege to get to be present at all of those times in life, and really a privilege that not a lot of people get. So it definitely enriches and broadens my life as well.
Well, I want to thank you both for sharing that experience. We all know a little bit more about this today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun.
I'm talking with Jency Carlson and Jamie Conniff of the University of Wisconsin Department of Family Medicine.
And that's it for today's Hidden Wisconsin segment, where we look behind the scenes at the work done by the people we rely on around the state.
And remember, we would love to hear your vote for our next Hidden Wisconsin segment. You can tell us what job you'd like to know more about, maybe an unsung job that we interface with every day, but we really don't know what happens there behind the scenes. Give us your vote. You can get in touch on our Facebook page, or you can send an email to centraltime@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you.
Maybe you can volunteer yourself for a future segment, too, at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk with the author of a new cookbook who says it's time we start thinking seriously about using bugs as food. And he's got lots of recipes to help us along the way.
Bug recipes. And we'll look at why the success of Netflix and streaming has changed the entire movie-making game in Hollywood.
Also, singer Steve Earle's in Wisconsin, and we'll chat with him about his music and his time on the hit TV show The Wire.
And we'll keep on top of the news of the day. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a new law in China requiring adult children to care for patients over 60 years old. Do we need a law like that here? We'll ponder that coming up in a few minutes. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.